Hello there, this is VK3OTN, the official station of the Radio Amateur Alzheimer's Club of Australia, with the monthly news broadcast for members and friends of the club for September 2024. This month, instead of the usual broadcast, we will offer an historical broadcast from years past. The usual news and information will be broadcast next month. I'm Andrew, VK3 Charlie Alpha Hotel. I have broadcast files going back as far as 2001. Many of the older files aren't the greatest as far as technical quality goes, archived in either Real Audio or Windows Media Audio format. These produced a smaller file size back in the days when the leading edge technology was dial-up internet. Remember that? This month we have an original broadcast from July 2002. Details on when to hear these news and information broadcasts are available at the club website, www.raotc.org.au. The VK3OTN is available on a wide range of radio platforms, HF, VHF and UHF, 2-meter repeaters, amateur television, DMR, that is digital mobile radio, and D-Star. These news broadcasts are available for download for up to 6 months, just in case you miss the original news broadcast from the RAOTC website. If you'd like to contact the club, then why not send us an email, raotc@raotc.org.au. I hope you enjoy this month's broadcast.
Hello there, this is Alan Dobell on VK3AMD and associated relay stations, the official call sign of the Radio Alzheimer's Club, VK3OTN. We still have no official reply to our submission for incorporation, so we'll report when we do get some news. And, of course, July the 1st, the start of the financial year, reminds me that our secretary tells me there's still about 20 people who have not yet paid their now overdue subs in spite of our sending out reminders. I do hope they don't have to drop off the membership list. And talking of membership, as I'll report shortly, inquiries about membership are increasing and with pleasing results. The primary source of inquiries are advertisement in AR magazine, which has been running for some time and is now producing inquiries from amateurs who have bought AR from the newsagents. Another source is inquiries from interested listeners who have taken part in one or other of our callback sessions after broadcast. This is all good news. OTN magazine, we hopefully will have that coming out on time in mid-September. The size will be standardized at A4 for a number of reasons. I know that's inconvenient for some people who'd like the old format, but the decisions have to be made. Broadcast times and frequencies will in future be printed in the magazine and not on the separate sheet with your postal address. It seems that many members mislay this sheet. Our friends in VK6 land will meet for their usual lunch gathering on Tuesday week, July the 9th, at the Bayswater Tavern. And hopefully the repeater relay of our 20-meter transmission to West Australia today will function as has been in recent broadcast sessions, with the repeater network there being very popular. Thanks for the guys over there who make that possible. This is VK3AMD and associated relay stations is VK3OTN. Today we welcome to membership Roger Conway, VK2RO, who becomes full member number 1255. John Eggington, VK3EGG, who becomes full member number 1256. Peter Cossens, VK3BFG, becomes full member number 1257. Lance Willoughby, VK4 Echo Whiskey, who becomes full member 1258. Rex Newsom, VK4 Lima Romeo, who becomes full member number 1259. Ernie Hocking, VK1 LK, who becomes life member 1260. J. Jeff Green, VK6 X-ray Bravo, becomes form number 1261. And Jim Gordon, VK5Z KK, who becomes like number 1262. That's a record number of new members in one broadcast, and we're very pleased about that. And as most of you will know, Ernie Hocking, VK1LK, is currently federal president of the WIA. If any of our new members are listening today, please identify yourself as such in one or other of the callback sessions. And it's with regret that I report the promise, the passing of Jim Humphreys, VK3ANH, who was member number 490. Let's pause now for just a few moments in memory of our departed friend. This is VK3ATN. Ron Cook, VK3AFW, tells us how he was led to his interest in amateur radio. And he says, I suppose it was early 1956. I was 14 and my shortwave listening was limited to tuning the family broadcast receiver to the top end of the dial and listening to the police transmitter VKC located in Russell Street, Melbourne. I was living on a farm some 40 miles away and my friend Jeff Bale, who also lived on a nearby farm, invited me over one Saturday afternoon. I pedalled over on my old bike. We mucked about for a while until the afternoon was wearing on. Come and see what I've bought, said Jeff. We traipsed off to his bedroom, where sitting on a small table was a large box with a smart black round dial in the middle. What's that, I said. It's a disposal receiver and transmitter, said Jeff. I peered at this modern marvel of defense science. Maybe the Army thought it was too out of date to keep, but to me it was as if communication satellites were to bounce into my lounge room today. I discovered that it used only one dial to tune the receiver and transmitter, and there were strange function switches with names like BFO and MCW, all quite unfathomable. What can you hear? What wavelength does it receive? I asked. Short wave and hams, said Jeff. Now this was a surprise, as my mother had told me about hams. They used to transmit music on Sundays before the war. Arch Woolnough was one she used to listen to on the family crystal set, and I'd assumed they didn't exist anymore. Jeff turned on the power switch, an impressive switch it was too. There was a whining noise, and I noticed that he had a car battery under the table. The noise, I later found, came from a thing called a generator and produced the HT. After a short time, he had a voice coming out of the speaker. The dial read something like 7.075 megacycles. Then the voice stopped talking a second, and a second voice started. They talked about aerials and transmitters and probably a lot of other things I've forgotten. Jeff tuned around using that beautiful black brake-like knob, and there were several different sets of stations talking. Some were as far away as Sydney and Adelaide. It was amazing. I was shown the circuit diagram. So many valves. There was a big one marked 807, which was the last stage of the transmitter. Over the next few months, we spent many hours listening around on 40 meters and started to learn about the jargon used by those strange people, the hams. We soon discovered that the number 11 would not transmit. I think there should have been a second generator. Whatever the reason, we were saved from being juvenile pirates. But the seed had been planted, and I started to wonder about becoming a radio amateur. Of course I did, but that was 5 years away and quite another story. The number 11 set did get used as a transmitter and was supplanted as a receiver later by an AR-8. Sadly, Jeff dismantled the number 11 for a few bits a few years later, but it did stir my interest in amateur radio. Interesting story from Ron. Thank you. This is VK3ATN with a croaky throat. Colin Harvey, VK1AU, has some thoughts about examinations, and here they are. Of late, there's been a tendency to consider the examinations for an amateur certificate of proficiency as too hard. In particular, strident calls to drop the Morse code have been based largely on input from those who did not put in enough effort to qualify. Failure in examinations is not rare, but the try-try-try-again syndrome seems to have gone from our national ethos. Over the periods 1967 to 1973, there were 416 attempts to pass the theory examinations necessary to achieve the first-class commercial certificate needed before one could become a marine operator. Of these, only 56 attempts were successful, and the papers were really not hard, providing a candidate had done his preparation. In the same period, 132 attempts were made to qualify by sending and receiving correctly Morse code groups at 20 words per minute, and plain language at 25 words per minute. Of these attempts, only 31 were successful. The following tabulations from the then Postmaster General's Department show that if you wanted to be a commercial operator, you needed to persevere, i.e., 1967-68, 37 attempts, 5 successful with certificates issued. 68-69, 28 attempts, of which 9 were successful and certified. 69-70, 17 attempts and 4 successful and certified. 70-71, 21 attempts and 2 successful and certified. 71-72, 15 attempts, of which 7 were successful and certified. 72-73, 14 attempts and only 4 successful and certified. The same can be said about the need for pilots to understand Morse code, and if you really want to be a pilot, you have to knuckle down and learn Morse. Why are amateurs different? If you want to be a real amateur operator, knuckle down and learn Morse. And by the way, unlike an amateur certificate of proficiency, which is valid in perpetuity, commercial certificates were subject to practical revalidation every 2 years and could be cancelled or suspended at any time at the discretion of the Postmaster General. Now, there's a good idea, and that's what Carl says. This is VKE3AMD, is VKE3OTN. Next little bit of history is typewritten, but I think it transcribes an article in a Tasmanian newspaper in the early 20s. There's no signature. It's headed, U.S. Warship Talks to England. I'm inclined to think it would have been about the time that an American Navy fleet visited Australia. It's headed, an interesting radio experience, U.S. Warship Talks to England. It says, while listening in on a wavelength of 43 metres on Sunday afternoon, Mr. T. Watkins, the well-known Hobart wireless experimenter, had the unique experience of picking up a two-way conversation carried out by wireless telephone between the United States warship Seattle and an experimental station in the United Kingdom, operated by the president of the British Radio Society, Mr. Gerald Marquez, G2NM. They were present with Mr. Watkins when the messages were picked up, Mrs. R.O. May and Ellen Jensen, both of whom heard the conversation quite distinctly. The first indication Mr. Watkins received of something being on the air was when he heard the Sydney amateur station 2CM calling G2OD London, the first English amateur station to establish wireless communication with Australia. While endeavouring to tune into the message being exchanged between the two stations, Mr. Watkins was surprised to hear the American warship NRRL, which appeared to be operating on a wavelength of 40 metres. The English station commenced by transmitting gramophone music. The NRRL said, "Put on some Jesse ones, hi." And later, "What about it ain't gonna rain no more? That's better, I'm receiving you okay." At about 6:15 a.m. Greenwich time, the English station began to call on American after first remarking that his transmissions were being carried out on exceedingly low power. It's believed that this was the first occasion that 2NM was heard in Australia. I think Snell and Rim was one of the people involved in that. I wouldn't be surprised. Some other people may have views on it. This is VK3OTN. Courtesy of Ray Peterson, 6PW, and Quinn Patchett, 6CW, and Bleak, 6ATN, we have the following extract from the ITEES Monitor, Volume 27, Issue 1, dated March-May 2002, and it's headed, "Exploding Chips to Foil Thieves." The new way of making silicon explode could mean anyone trying to use a stolen laptop or mobile phone can get more than they bargained for. New Scientist reports until now silicon has only been made to explode by mixing it with either liquid oxygen or nitric acid. But Michael Saylor and his colleagues at the University of California in San Diego have found a way to blow up silicon chips using an electrical signal. Their method could be used to fry circuitry and devices that fall into the wrong hands. For instance, if the American spy plane impounded by China last year had the technology, it could be used to destroy the plane's secret electronic system. Saylor's team made the discovery when they applied the oxidizing chemical gadolinium nitrate to a porous silicon wafer. His colleague Fred Mikulek used a diamond scribe to split the wafer. It blew up in his face, giving Mikulek the shock of his life. The gadolinium nitrate used the energy from the diamond scribe to oxidize the silicon film, which burns fast because its crystals have a large surface area. The faster the burn, the bigger the bang, explained Saylor. Only a tiny quantity of the chemical is needed to do irreparable damage to delicate transistors, so it'd be cheap and easy to add when the chips were being made. In a stolen mobile phone, the network would send a trigger signal to the part of the chip containing the gadolinium nitrate detonator, triggering the explosion. We've shown you how you can store this stuff and detonate it at will, Saylor said. That ends the quote from that magazine. Interesting. This is VK3OTN. Tom Berg, VK6ZAE, was a boy living at Ventnor in the Isle of Wight during World War II, and in a letter to Arthur Evans, he has the following paragraph. He says, I have a number of World War II reminiscences from the age 4 to 10 years old. At Ventnor, the Isle of Wight, where my mother ran a boarding house which cost too much for tradesmen, and we had engineers and specialists for radar as visitors at 400 feet above sea level. I woke up on the 5th of June 1944 and saw the Eastern brackets Commonwealth and Western brackets USA fleets join the mineswept path to Europe. That's from Tom Berg, VK6ZIF. Interesting, memorable experience. This is VK3OTN. Dorothy Moffat, who used to be VK4RD, has sent us an interesting story about her mother's brother, Tom Perry, who died in 1963. She's entitled it Tom the Telegraphist. William Thomas Perry was Willie to his family and Tom to everybody else. Born in 1887, he was the youngest boy in the highest class when a gold medal for proficiency was awarded at the Mackay Boys State School. A solicitor was impressed and asked if he wanted to join the firm. Tom's fate was sealed when he protested that I would have to tell lies. Tom was interested in telegraphy, so his father ran a wire across backyards and across Alfred Street to a school friend's home, and the two boys practiced the Morse code. Tom became a good telegraphist and joined the telegraph office, which was housed in the River Street post office. After some years, he became ill, and the cure was to live in a high, dry, cool climate, so he was sent to Albury to live. While there, he got better and took up his work again. After the war broke out, Tom enlisted in 1915 and was passed as medically fit at Moree. He was allocated to the 13th Reinforcement 1st Signalers Company, No. 2 Section, Regimental No. 5211. His company left for Egypt, and on leave in Cairo, soldiers had so few pence to spend that he wrote a letter in protest to a Sydney paper. He wanted action. By June, they were in Plymouth, and now he was with the Army Postal Corps, 1st Division Signalers Company. Sapper Perry was sent to France to several areas. While sending and receiving messages, Tom learned the true state of affairs as the tide of battle ebbed and flowed. He was utterly shocked to hear that men were expendable. There were plenty more men, but horses were in short supply and had to be specially treated and conserved. And Tom was moved to write several letters or articles to a New South Wales paper. His published words created a furore and were traced to him. He was silenced. today, he would have been sued. On leaving London, he met his only brother, Jack. He served with the British and French Army Reserve in Italy and France. In 1919, Tom Perry was returned to England and boarded the war prize, the Prince Ludwig, to reach Australia. He reached his parents' home in Mackay and settled. He didn't want to be shut in within four walls again. He thought he'd become a fruit and vegetable grower like some other returned men at Seaforth, north of Mackay, and he took his books and his ideas with him, and made a living for himself. During the Pacific War, Tom rejoined the Postmaster General's department and did whatever job they chose him to do. He retired to live beside a beautiful water lily pool and died aged 76 years, and his disturbed spirit was finally at rest. In a footnote, Dorothy says that Tom had avoided censorship by putting his letters last in the mailbag before it was sealed. Interesting sidelight on telegraphy. Seem to have a bit of that Morse code in telegraphy today, don't we? This is VK3AMD, it's VK3OTN. Here's an extract from a letter to Arthur Evans from Jim Davis, VK7OW. I have just come across a letter you wrote to me some time ago. You suggested I get a copy of The Eavesdroppers from the library. Well, I did, and it certainly answered a few questions. In the picture showing the number three Cartagena operators, one of these was the late Harold Bates. He just happened to be my brother-in-law. He married my sister Bede, who lives up on the Gold Coast. Harold could speak fluent Japanese and Cantonese. After the war, he got a job with the Australian Diplomatic Corps and spent 12 years in Hong Kong, where their two children were born. Later, he was transferred to Washington, D.C., and they lived in Bethesda in Maryland. We never knew what he did during the war, but later when he was married, I remember my sister telling me once that he had a black attaché case and told them never to go near it. In 1981 and 92, they visited Tasmania, and during their visit, they called to see us. I took Harold out to my museum, where at that time I had quite a number of antique radios and phonographs, etc. One of these radios was an AR-7, which was actually used by the RAAF. I started to tell him all about it, and so on, and he said, "It's quite an interesting set, isn't it?" Little did I know that the bugger knew more about the AR-7 than I did. Now I know what he did. And by the way, my AR-7's in superb condition. Interesting letter. Thank you for that. This is VK3OTN. May 1987 issue of AR has a short article about the then centenary of Heinrich Hertz's experiment, which led to radio as we know it. The writer was Jim Litton, VK3PC. Using a primitive type of spark transmitter, young German physicist Heinrich Hertz caused a small spark to leap across a very small gap between two ends of a large resonant loop of wire placed near the transmitter. The scientific breakthrough, which contributed greatly to the advance of knowledge, occurred exactly a century ago, that was in May 1887, a century ago from the time of the article, and could be described as the birth of wireless communication. Hertz had, in fact, proved a theoretical prediction made some 22 years earlier by Scottish physicist James Clerk Maxwell, who at Cambridge University was the first to suggest that electrical waves could travel through space. In theory, such waves would have the frequency and wavelength of water waves or sound waves, but would travel at the speed of light. British physicist Sir Oliver Lodge, reflecting on the Hertz breakthrough, later wrote a book called Talking About Wireless in 1925, and said Hertz showed how to produce them practically and what was more, how to detect them at a distance in an elementary and purely laboratory fashion. Further improvement in detecting appliances was soon devised by many people, and in due time they were amenable to practical and commercial use by the energy and enterprise of Senator Marconi and his co-workers. To a public ignorant of the work of Clerk Maxwell and Hertz, this application, Marconi's, came as a great surprise and seemed very novel and mysterious. To physicists, it did not seem so. It was a natural application of what was known. Hertz, in a book, Propagation of Electric Action with Finite Velocity Through Space, published in 1893, mentions similar experimental work carried out by others at the same time as his successful 1887 experiment. He said there was scarcely any doubt that Lodge would have also been successful in observing waves in air and proving propagation of electric force. Judging by the writings of Lodge and Hertz, there is nothing but a cordial and frank appreciation among the physicists of the day. Hertz, who was professor of physics in the University of Bonn, died in January 1, 1894, in his 37th year. Another young man, Marconi, read mention of Hertz's experiments in his obituary, which set him on his course to make a practical use of Hertzian waves. Marconi, based on the work of Hertz and a number of other early radio experimenters, conducted short-range practical tests in 1896. In 1897, he sent and received messages over a distance of about 7 miles, and by 1898 had established two-way wireless communication across the English Channel. In 1901, Marconi at St. John's, Newfoundland, received the Morse code letter S, transmitted to him by Professor Fleming, later to invent the thermionic valve, from Pondu, Cornwall, England. As the 20th century was dawning, the era of wireless experimenters had begun, and hundreds of radio amateurs in Europe, America, Australia were inspired by news of Marconi's transatlantic communication. Rudimentary transmitters and receivers were constructed during the next decade. Wireless Institute of Australia was founded in 1910, and by the outbreak of World War I, the amateur radio movement was firmly established in many parts of the world. Many years later, in an effort to pay a lasting tribute to Hertz, his name was adopted internationally as the unit per cycle per second. Thus we have Hertz, kilohertz, megahertz, and gigahertz. So let us modern wave radio amateurs and shortwave listeners think for a moment of Heinrich Hertz in the centenary year of his birth, which it was when that article was written. Thanks, Jim. This is VK380N. The next item is not about radio, but it comes from the 1997 issue of the Journal of the Air Force's Amateur Radio Net. The writer was Jack Royans, who enlisted in the Empire Air Training Scheme at the age of 19. His story is entitled An Unfriendly Flying Object. Picture it. Canada, May 1943. A lone RCAF Apo Anson carrying 3 trainee Australian navigators and piloted by a Canadian pilot is flying over the Gulf of St. Lawrence, Nova Scotia. The purpose of the flight is a navigation exercise over the ice floes in the Gulf, but the pilot has other ideas. As soon as the schedule work is finished, he starts shooting up the fishing boats which are dotted about the murky, cold sea. No doubt great fun for him, and undoubtedly good training for any future he might have as a ground attack pilot. However, as one of the navigators, I must say it was a very hair-raising experience, and I felt decidedly uneasy. It must have been scary too for the fishermen, and uncomfortable, for the boats were left rocking madly in the maelstrom created by the aircraft's slipstream. Then it happened. The pilot was making his third pass over one particular boat, and I can still see it. A fisherman stood up and threw something at us. There was one heck of a bang, and a neat half-inch diameter hole was punched through the right-hand windscreen. Sitting in the cold pilot's seat, I was immediately covered by fish scales. It was a fish that he had thrown at us. There were scales all over maps and equipment, and fortunately no guts or other fishy remains. A very chastened pilot set course back to our base at Summerside on Prince Edward Island, and he directed me to make a log entry struck by seagull. It was a frightening experience and could easily have led to disaster if the fish had struck the pilot's windscreen instead. No doubt we all learned an obvious lesson that day, don't shoot up fishing boats. Later, while relating our adventure to our mates, I could see the funny side of the flight, especially the bit about the seagull. Much later, I was a navigator on Coastal Command Wellington's carrying out E-boat patrols up the Dutch coast. Although our aircraft was hit many times by light aircraft, nothing made the noise or scared me so much as that first encounter with an unfriendly flying object. Interesting little story, wasn't it? This is VK3ATN. And just in case you missed it in the paper, or on the radio or TV, there was a very interesting item about the invention of the telephone. It was published about the middle of June. The United States Congress has carried a resolution declaring that Alexander Graham Bell was not the real inventor of the telephone. He took his patent 16 years after an Italian-born engineer in America had taken a temporary patent and made demonstrations in 1860. His name was Antonio Meucci and shared a laboratory with Bell. Meucci sued Bell and looked like winning, but died in 1889 and the case was dropped. So much for history. This is VK3ATN for the Radio Amateur Alzheimer's Club. We invite interested amateurs to join the club. There are two grades of membership. Full membership's available to those who have been licensed for 25 years or more. Associate membership's available to those who have been licensed for 10 years or more. Age doesn't enter into it. Subscriptions are currently $8 per annum plus a joining fee of $5. These figures apply to both grades of membership. Members get two interesting magazines each year, one in March and one in September. Associate members become full members automatically when the 25-year date comes up. Associate members cannot hold office in the club. That's the only difference. If you'd like to receive a membership application form, please contact our secretary, Arthur Evans, VK3VQ, telephone 03-9598-4262. I'll repeat that. 03-9598-4262, or myself, Alan Doble, VK3AMD, telephone 03-9570-4610, 9570-4610. We're both QTHR and any call book. This is VK3ATN. And I nearly forgot the story about the middle-aged lady who invited her young daughter-in-law one afternoon, who visited her young daughter-in-law one afternoon. To her surprise, the young lady, when she opened the door, was not wearing any clothes. The older lady was naturally a bit startled, and after she got over the shock, asked the younger lady for an explanation. The younger woman said, "This is my love dress." Mother-in-law was fairly broad-minded, so she offered no criticism or comment, and the afternoon proceeded as planned. After she got home, she thought about the afternoon's event and decided, just for fun, she'd check the reaction of her husband, Joe, to a similar situation. So she took off her clothes as home time approached. When Joe arrived home, he was startled and demanded to know what was going on. His wife said, "This is my love dress. What do you think about it?" He looked her up and down for a few minutes and said, "I reckon I could do it a bit of ironing." On that happy note, I'll leave you to our next merry meeting. This is Alan Doble, VK3AMD, and associated relay stations is VK3ATN, the official call sign of the Radio Amateur Alzheimer's Club. We're about to conclude our transmission for this month and hope you found it interesting. We're on the air again on the 5th of August and Monday the 2nd of September at the same time as today. The callback sessions which will follow will take two forms to enable us to get a good picture of our listening audience. First call will be for listeners to give only their name and call sign just to let us know you were listening. Then we'll be looking for all who wish to make reports or comments. And we look forward to lots of both types of call. Thank you for listening to 73 VK3AMD, going clear.
You have been listening to VK3OTN. VK3OTN is the official station of the Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club, Australia. This concludes this month's news and information bulletin. The next RAOTC news and information broadcast will take place on the first Monday of next month, on the same frequencies and at the same times as today, with the exception of January. Thanks for being with us, and we hope you will join in the callbacks where callbacks are taken. 73 everyone.